May it please the Court. I'm Gabriel Fuentes, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Clacy Watson Herrera. And in my limited time, I'd like to outline a clear path toward reversal of Mr. Herrera's conviction. I'd like
to ask you, interrupting your clear path, is your view that fingerprint evidence is so unreliable it should be inadmissible?
No, that's not what Mr. Herrera has argued. He's argued that the particular fingerprint opinion that was rendered here, which is that the latent prints recovered from Roberson Seizure 2 were a match, and the examiner used the word match to Mr. Watson's fingers, that's an opinion that's not been validated anywhere. There's no research to back up the notion that any examiner can give that kind of testimony. The National Academy of Sciences report from 2009 specifically said that that type of opinion lacked research support.
But weren't they talking about fingerprint evidence in general and not just about this particular type of fingerprint evidence?
Well, there's a lengthy passage from the NAS report that describes fingerprint evidence in general and the method, the ACEV method.
So what is it that you... I got the strong sense from your brief of great skepticism about fingerprint evidence in general.
Well, I think Mr. Watson very clearly attacked the ACEV method. The NAS report stated that that method is not specific enough to qualify as a validated method for identification.
But was there anything that you raised in your brief regarding the weakness of fingerprint evidence that you were not able to raise with the jury? In other words, if you were fully able to attack any of the flaws in the fingerprint evidence, why wouldn't this be harmless error at its worst?
Well, Judge, I think the government has said a number of times, I know they said it on mandamus, that the fingerprint evidence was critical, that it was of immense probative value to them because they wanted to corroborate the rest of the evidence, which was all cooperator testimony. Judge, there was cross-examination on fingerprints. It was a very rigorous cross-examination. But Daubert tells us that the district court is the gatekeeper. If evidence doesn't meet a standard of reliability and validity, it doesn't come in.
So you are making a categorical argument.
As to the particular opinion rendered here, and that was the opinion that was offered at the trial through an expert report
that we objected to. What is the matter with this particular type of fingerprint evidence?
That there's no research whatsoever.
What is the problem? No, concretely, not the conclusion. What's the problem with this evidence?
You have a jury which hears an examiner.
Not the jury. Look, the evidence. What is the problem with it? I know what fingerprinting is, right? You put your finger on a ink pad, okay? And then it's sent off to Washington, and they have guys who compare it with other fingerprints. Right? They sort it and then compare it. So what's different here?
Well, here there was an exhibit. There was some brown tape, and from that tape were recovered two latent fingerprints. And as we learned from the NAS report, latent fingerprint images are different even from the same finger every time they're left.
Now, what's a latent fingerprint?
That's the print that if I touch this podium with my thumb,
what's a latent fingerprint?
It's the image from the oils of my finger that have been deposited on a piece of evidence.
Ink pad.
As opposed to a rolled print that would be done in a controlled setting.
Are you saying that all latent fingerprint evidence should be inadmissible?
No, I'm saying that any latent fingerprint evidence of an identification, namely this is Mr. Watson's fingerprint, could be admissible only if it were backed by a showing that an examiner could really render that opinion, that there is validity to that notion.
An examiner could really render an opinion. Aren't you arguing that the scientific evidence is that latent fingerprints are simply unreliable for identification?
No.
I think what's a good latent fingerprint versus the latent fingerprints here?
We don't know because that research hasn't been done, Judge. And that's the critical question.
What kind of latent fingerprints do you think are admissible?
I would say that it is possible.
I don't want possible. What kind of latent fingerprints, if any, do you believe are admissible?
A latent fingerprint to which an examiner testifies that there are similarities, that there may be a number of similarities. Here's what the similarities are. Jury, let me show you what they are. Not as what occurred here. This is Mr. Watson's fingerprint.
They can't declare a match.
That's correct, Judge. And in fact, if you look at the Swigfast statement that we cited in our reply brief,
they have presumably they have good fingerprints of him, which they then compare with his with a latent fingerprint. Is that the idea?
Smudged partial latent print off a piece of tape.
They have good fingerprints of him, right?
Yes, Judge.
Okay, and they compare it with the latent fingerprint, right? And you say that the latent. So my question is: Are there good latent fingerprints and bad? Is that the problem? Is this a bad latent fingerprint, or are all latent fingerprints so equivocal that they should never be used for identification? There's no use for them. That's what they're
to
for.
Respond to Your Honor's question. I think. The Nash report is in the record, and in the Nash report, that report discusses how there's a wide variety of different quality of latent fingerprints. I think there's a great degree of subjectivity in this discipline because there's no set number of points of similarity.
I don't like fingerprint evidence. I know that.
Well, to try to...
Do you think eyewitness testimony is more reliable than latent fingerprint evidence?
Judge, I don't know, because I don't know how reliable
so maybe
latent fingerprint testimony
is. Eyewitness testimony either. Is that your idea?
There are experts who say that it should not be, but I think the issue in this case is, has this particular opinion and this particular method of identification of a latent fingerprint, has it been shown to be reliable?
How is this method different from other methods of using latent fingerprints to identify?
I would say this particular method, the ACEV method, is, from our understanding in the record, the preeminent, predominant mode of identifying someone's latent fingerprints. And so I don't know that I could tell the court from the record or from anywhere else if there's some other method out there.
You're saying what was used here is the standard method of interpreting latent fingerprints?
Yes.
But you're challenging it.
It's the method that the National Academy of Sciences, a very august government body,
right,
charged with.
So you're saying latent fingerprints can't be used in evidence because the standard method of interpreting them has been challenged by the National Academy of Sciences.
Well, I'm
That's
saying...
That's what you're saying.
I'm saying
Why
that...
Hedge? Why hedge? That's what you're saying. The standard method is no good. It's too unreliable. It's questioned by scientists. It shouldn't be used. Now go and look at the literature on eyewitness testimony, and you'll find the same thing. A lot of solid research that says eyewitness testimony is frequently unreliable. So on your theory, it should be inadmissible.
Well, Judge, perhaps the answer to your question is that I don't think the Seventh Circuit has to go that far. Because in this case, which makes this case a little different.
It's not different. All you're saying is latent fingerprint evidence has been challenged by scientists. And we know that eyewitness testimony is, in fact, often unreliable. But we allow it in. Now, the fact that latent fingerprint testimony may often be unreliable, that's a reason for cross-examination, for instructing jurors that fingerprint evidence is not infallible, as they might think, but not for exclusion.
Well, let me offer this distinction, Your Honor. The latent fingerprint evidence that is offered in cases and was offered here is offered through an expert, a fingerprint examiner who is qualified to testify as to these issues and who the jury, through Rule 403, there's a greater risk of them placing emphasis on that evidence.
I don't think anyone is qualified.
Well, the Daubert case, the Supreme Court noted that Rule 403 is a part of the analysis.
People employed by the FBI, they believe in this stuff. You don't want them testifying.
And in the Mayfield case, four of them got it wrong. And the problem is...
Right, I know, but the problem is there are plenty of cases where eyewitness testimony was shown later to be mistaken. But we don't infer from this we shouldn't allow eyewitness testimony.
Well, and I suppose I'm telling the court that I don't believe we would necessarily apply Daubert to eyewitness testimony. I mean, those are fact witnesses. When you have an expert come in and say, I'm the person who works at the lab, I know this material.
If evidence is unreliable, it's unreliable.
Maybe I could jump in here and try to clarify what I think your position is, which is to say that not that fingerprint evidence is categorically inadmissible, but that fingerprint evidence that declares an exact match ought to be inadmissible in light of this NAS report, and that the norm that prevails in other areas of forensic expert testimony, such as hair samples and some ballistics experts, testify to the consistency between, you know, an evidentiary sample and a control sample, for example, rather than an exact match. Is that a fair characterization of your argument?
I think the court has it exactly right. I think this match testimony would have to be shown to have some threshold level of reliability before it could come in. And we now know from the scientific working group of the fingerprint examiners in their 2012 pronouncement, they're telling their examiners to back off that kind of testimony. And that's a very significant point, because in the Rose case, which is a district court case out of Baltimore, one of the few cases to consider the NAS report after it has issued, the Rose case relied on the scientific working group's pronouncements to say that this could be done. And, in fact, it can't be done. I'm into my rebuttal time. I've got many, many more points for the court.
Time has expired, actually, but you can take another a minute. Look, how much of this is re-arguing our previous opinion?
I think many of the points we did make before on the brief we filed overnight.
Again, now, do you have something new? Is this NAS report new or what?
Oh, well, as to the NAS report, that was never litigated before, Judge.
That's the merits. Okay, but what with regard to the issues we discussed in our previous opinion, has anything changed in the legal firmament or cause us to re-examine what we said?
Not in the legal firmament. The court now has the time and the opportunity to review this record, which was a complicated record. It was a record that was presented to the court by one of the parties.
If you think we did not review it, staying up many nights, you are grossly mistaken.
Your Honor, I think it would be fair to give this defendant an opportunity to be heard, to provide a proper level of appellate briefing, to describe what it was about the record.
What is the proper level of appellate briefing?
It would be something other than filing a brief overnight, which is what occurred here, and a motion for rehearing, a petition for rehearing that was filed within minutes of the court's order. So I think the procedure offered here on direct appeal has been perfectly appropriate, because it's allowed Mr. Watson to advise the court that what Judge Holderman did when he excluded Roberson in Seizure 2 was that he wanted a witness to testify from personal knowledge as to the change in the weight of that drug, because he observed the bags himself, he saw no additional bags, and an assistant U.S. attorney said to the judge she did not know why the drug grew. He wanted a witness with personal knowledge. The government found out who it was and couldn't bring that person to court, and the judge exercised his discretion against the admission of that evidence.
Did the assistant U.S. attorney not state something to the effect of it was rebagged the way it always is?
Yes, and the judge stated, the AUSA stated he didn't know that from personal knowledge, and he didn't have a witness who could testify to it from personal knowledge. He called one witness who said that she thought it might have been explained by differences in the use of the scale, which the district court found very strange, given that people go to jail based on 20-gram quantities of narcotics. So there was a lot of questions. They were legitimate questions for this judge to ask.
What do you mean when you said a petition for rehearing filed within minutes? What is that about?
Judge, the court was considering the mandamus petition. The court did not ask the defendant for briefing. The order came in at about 3:50 in the afternoon. We were preparing
We issued a long opinion. Well, maybe not long, but it was certainly a normal opinion. It's not hasty or rushed. Now, you could file a petition for rehearing, right, after we issued our opinion?
It didn't work that way because...
Pardon?
It didn't work that way here because the trial was going on. There was a jury in the box.
Going on because you want you want to reserve the right to nullify it. So what was to stop you from filing at your leisure within our normal rehearing time a petition for rehearing?
This court's order. This court ordered that the trial resume immediately.
Yes, that the trial resume. But meanwhile, look, you're challenging the results of the trial now. What was to keep you from... I'm in trouble finding something, but... What was to keep you from filing a... Yeah, so we issued an opinion July 30th of 2010, and it's it's pretty long.
Because by then the trial would be over, and it was a trial that was compelled to resume by this court before a substitute judge under what Mr. Watson has contended was an unprecedented and incorrect application of Rule 25.
Our opinion was July 30th, 2010. That's more than 2 years ago. Now, couldn't you, after July 10th, couldn't you ask for rehearing within, a couple of weeks? Why'd it have to languish for 2 years?
Well, much happened in that two-year period.
Look, why didn't you file something after July 2010?
Because at that point, trial counsel was preparing to challenge the fingerprint evidence, preparing to argue, to complete the trial, to try to...
When was the trial finished?
Trial didn't finish until August 4th, Judge. And it finished on August 4th after the two interruptions caused by mandamus. I think, honestly, I don't know of another case in the history of this building.
Oh, come on.
Well, I won't complete that thought.
Look, Judge Holderman's courtroom demeanor left a lot to be desired. And this court was very concerned. And the opinion was not rushed out, this July 30th opinion. And there was ample opportunity at that point, if you thought we'd overlooked something, to bring it to our attention, rather than to wait 2 years.
Well, Your Honor, we did go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ordered the government to respond to the cert petition. The government responded. The Supreme Court ultimately denied cert.
Why did you skip out? Why didn't you ask us for rehearing before going to the Supreme Court?
We did, and in the written opinion of July 30th, the court denied the rehearing petition. So
that was when we, after we issued our opinion?
There were two orders the court issued. There was a short one- or two-sentence order.
Yes, I know, but we issued a full opinion. Now, what happened after that?
After that, the defendant proceeded to the completion of his trial, jury deliberations, jury verdict, and then there was a cert petition during which sentencing was stayed.
You didn't ask us, you didn't say your opinion. Now you've spelled out everything at length, and you overlooked this, and you overlooked that, and you overlooked the other thing. And you could have... Because you were in a big hurry, so you made mistakes. So you could have asked us to correct our mistakes. Why are you shaking your head?
Did you file something? I honestly believe, Judge, that trial counsel here filed for rehearing petition immediately because trial counsel felt that was necessary to stop that trial from resuming under a circumstance in which the trial judge, who had been seen to have been clashing with the government, was removed. The jury then returns from mandamus to see a new judge on the bench, an extraordinary event, a high, high, high risk of prejudice. And I think trial counsel rightly felt that that trial should not continue at that point. And the best way to stop it was to tell the court all trial counsel could about why it shouldn't happen. And trial counsel would totally respect the court's views, much as he or she would disagree with them. And I think that's why we're here. We went to the Supreme Court right away. The government said, why don't you bring everything up in a single cert petition? And so here we are on direct appeal, and I think my client, Mr. Watson, is very, very satisfied to receive an opportunity to really brief these issues fully.
I'd like to disabuse you of one notion. I know of a number of cases in this building where a new judge has taken over. Illness, all sorts of different events. And juries in this building have seen a new judge without explanation. You know, we don't go and say, your judge has become ill. So I know that, you know, as lawyers, you may not realize that these things occur, but they really, really, really do.
And Judge, I thank you. I think Mr. Watson does understand that. I think this is an extraordinary case in which the trial judge did not exit for illness or death, exited after this very extraordinary colloquy that the court commented on, that Judge Posner mentioned a moment ago. The court believed it many times was inappropriate. And I think in the meantime, the jury is sitting there listening to this and then sees that the figure in conflict with the government is gone. We've researched any other case where Rule 25 has ever been applied to that circumstance, or where other disability, as those words are used in Rule 25, could ever apply to that circumstance. So we didn't find any order to the government.
A mistrial with a new jury? Is that what you wanted?
I think a mistrial with a new jury was the only choice once the court decided that Judge Holderman had to go under these circumstances.
Okay. Well. Thank you, Mr. Jury.
Thank you.
Mr. Fuentes. Ms. Kastanek?
Thank you. May it please this court, my name is Andriana Kastanek and I represent the United States. I'll address briefly the defendant's first argument with regards to the propriety of the mandamus petition.
Oh.
You can go ahead,
sir. When you said first issue, I thought you were going to go into the fingerprint.
Oh. Well, I was going to address just briefly this mandamus issue.
Sure.
This panel obviously understood the law and the facts of this case when it decided the previous petition granting the government's writ of mandamus. It determined that mandamus was proper. It determined that given the conduct of the district judge that was proceeding, that substitution was an effective remedy, and this is not the proper vehicle to reassess those conclusions. With regards to the defendant's Daubert arguments, there is a little bit of a moving target here, and so I'm going to address first the argument that was made in his initial brief that fingerprint identification evidence should be categorically barred, which I understand him to make at pages 21 and 31 of his brief. And then I will turn to the more narrow argument that he makes in his reply, as well as that oral argument with regards to the expert's conclusion that there was a match here.
Before you do that, in Hafford, we said that the error rate for fingerprint analysis is exceptionally low. Is there any scientific basis to support that statement anymore? Does anyone know what the error rate actually is?
I mean, I can't tell you the mathematical error rate. And that is one of the that is something that was at issue in the NAS report, that this was an area that called for further research. But the fact of the matter is that this court has repeatedly addressed this issue. It addressed it in Havern and numerous times since then, and determined that fingerprint identification evidence is, as a general matter, reliable.
Right, but does that foreclose the issue for all time?
Well, of course it doesn't, Your Honor. But the NAS report has been out for 3 years now. In its substance, it is very similar to the types of publications that this court addressed in Havard. So in Havard, this court talked about the National Institute of Justice solicitation, which called for additional research into these exact issues. It talked about another study that also called for additional research.
What would
validation.
It take for a defendant to join issue on this particular kind of Daubert challenge under this circuit's precedent?
What would they have to prove?
What would they have to allege in a motion or proffer in a motion to get an evidentiary hearing on this issue? The judge just decided this based on our precedent and denied the Daubert motion.
Well, I think that there would have to, and this kind of brings me into the defendant's second argument, that there would have to be something unique about these fingerprints or unique about the testing, unique about the comparison that was done.
So the defendant can never challenge the mode in which the expert expresses the opinion? Other words, challenge that it's expressed as a conclusion as to a match?
I mean, generally they could, but with respect to fingerprint identification evidence, I mean, this has been briefed and decided by this court. So as a, you know, the science indicates.
At this level of technical specificity? I think that's the import of Judge Rovner's questions about the Hart case.
I don't think that there is anything that the NAS report changes with regard to technical specificity that would render it appropriate for this court to reconsider.
Was there anything unusual about the expert's testimony?
Okay, and I think that there need to be some misrepresentations or misapprehensions with regard to this expert's testimony clarified here. So in the reply brief and at oral argument, the defense seems to change their argument to be that this expert shouldn't have been able to conclude that there was a match. What he describes with respect to not being able to make that comparison is a much more appropriate critique of if there's a partial print. So in this area, unlike, you know, if you have DNA testing or bullet casing comparisons where it's really difficult to make a match. So if you have a blood sample and you have a defendant's known DNA, the DNA expert likely will not conclude that there's an exact match because you need so many alleles of a DNA strand. So instead it's reflected or represented in terms of a probability. That's not the case with fingerprints. If there's a full print and, you know, all of the impressions of that latent print are on an item as they were here. So there were two full latent prints that were on the Robertson seizure two that were found and analyzed by the Customs and Border Patrol agents. They also had full known prints of the defendant, and so when they compared them, they could make an exact match. If there were partial prints, that would be a completely different story.
Partial print challenges have been around forever, so
sure.
That's not what this case is about. This is a head-on challenge to this form of expert testimony as to fingerprint matches.
Absolutely, and so that's why I'm clarifying, because the defendant seems to be representing it in terms of the issues that surround partial prints.
The general questioning, you know, Judge Pollack's decision in Pennsylvania, the general problem with fingerprint evidence compared to DNA testing is scientific, and they determine with exactitude whether, you know, you have an identical allele. So, but with fingerprints, it's just someone looking at them, right?
That's correct. You know, It's a different type of science. So fingerprints don't require chemistry or physics or biology in the same way that other expert scientific evidence done. It literally is the training of.
You call it science because it's like authenticating a work of art, right?
Well, that's correct.
This is a Rembrandt, you know, it looks like him, but on the other hand, he didn't usually paint. His women's fingernails or something like that. So isn't that what's going on here?
Right, and I don't think that delegitimizes this area of expert testimony.
That's why it creates concerns, because...
Right. I think that the import of that, of your point, is that it takes it out of this area that needs the type of validation that the defendant is asking for. The type of validation that's required is the peer review that was done to have... I'm sorry.
I've been trying to, you know, get around all of this because the defendant was allowed a vigorous cross-examination.
Absolutely.
Was able to point out to the jury every possible flaw in fingerprint science, including the lack of statistical evidence that, you know, supports its accuracy. But the fingerprint expert here is only part of the picture for this piece of evidence. The evidence in question, and I don't know why anyone hasn't mentioned it, I mean, was extracted from the body cavity of a woman,
right,
who testified that the defendants gave it to her to carry. That's pretty compelling evidence absent.
Right. And so with respect to the defendant's argument that the evidence in this case was unreliable for some reason, you are exactly right that there is significant corroboration to these prints. So he was identified by a positive match with respect to the prints. The jury heard from Ms. Robertson, the person from whom this item was extracted. She explained that the defendant had you know, taken the package, put his prints on it, put a condom, taped it, put it into her, or she put it into her body. And so there was a significant amount of evidence at this
trial.
She
had credibility problems, didn't she? I mean, every witness does, but, well.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
I think that there,
the
was, a
right?
I mean, there was a significant amount of evidence, and her statements on this particular issue were corroborated by the fingerprint expert. And one just additional point about this is not only was there cross-examination of the defense or the government's expert, but there were dueling experts on the issues more generally about the problems with scientific evidence in this context, misidentification of Mayfield, those topics that are raised, but also about the more specific issues regarding the defendant, the match that was opined by the government's expert. If there are no further questions, we would ask that this court affirm the judgment and conviction of the defendant.
Thank you, Ms. Castaner. Mr. Fuentes, your time expired, but we'll give you another minute.
I'll be as brief as I possibly can, and I want to just respond to a few things the government said. First of all, the brief and the argument in this appeal have not been a moving target, and I would point the court to page 1 of the initial brief in which we stated that we were challenging the testimony about the prints being a match, and it's at the bottom of that page. Second of all, it probably would be incumbent on the court that Mr. Watson would request that the court review the actual fingerprint images because the government has stated that they were full latent fingerprints. I think the government should, the court would benefit from looking at the actual images because I think Mr. Watson would have a very different view of just how full they were. Thirdly, with regard to...
Isn't that itself a matter for an expert? How are we going to be able to tell?
Well, I think it would enlighten the court to this notion that somehow these fingerprints were of such great quality that they could easily and reliably be compared. I mean, that's the kind of issue that ultimately a Daubert challenge would go to. And,
yes, I know, but we're not experts, so...
Well, I just...
More than we could authenticate a work of art, right? Even something might be obvious to an expert.
I just wanted...
Invisible to a layperson.
Right, and I just wanted to disabuse the court of the notion that it would somehow be very clear from looking at the images. Then finally, with regard to how clear the rest of the evidence was, I mean, the only component of the rest of the evidence on Mr. Watson concerning Roberson's seizure 2 was the testimony of a cooperator that he was the one who gave it to her. The fingerprints were the linchpin in allegedly tying it to him. So there wasn't a lot of other evidence as to that. And finally, there were no dueling experts. The defense presented an expert in the scientific method who presented testimony about why there was no scientific basis for validity or reliability of this type of opinion. And the defense did not present a fingerprint examination expert to differ or challenge the examiner's testimony. The defense instead put on an exhibit that actually showed the features because the examiner's testimony obscured the features with colored dots, and the defendant presented something else. So those were four things I wanted to mention on rebuttal. If the court has any other questions, I'm glad to answer them, but I see my time is up.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Fuentes. Mr. Fuentes, and were you appointed, were you not?
Absolutely, Judge.
Yeah. Well, we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.